Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Very pleased to welcome back to Denver, Kyle Boaty. Bolty. Let's see how many times I can mess this up. He did. So, Borchesky is next. Anyway, Kyle, let's go with that, is a finalist for the Annie Dillard Award, and his writing has appeared in Orion Magazine, Full Stop, Sierra, The Rumpus, The Millions, and High Country News, among several others. Tonight, he joins us along with longtime friend and editor, Shane Boris, who has advised and collaborated with artists, musicians, and filmmakers around the world to discuss his new book, The Beautiful Unseen. Please join me in welcoming Shane Boris and Kyle. Bolty. All right.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction.
I met Kyle Bouglier when Kyle came in fifth grade, moving from Kansas to Colorado, and we've been friends ever since. Grew up together, and we even once we got into high school started a poetry club together, of which Kyle now joins the illustrious ranks of many multiple published authors and great prestigious award winners. And I'm here in the capacity of a friend of one of these like incredible writers. And it's an honor to be here and to have participated in a small way in the book and in this evening, just truly as a friend. And it feels great to also share the space with so many friends as well.
I'm really honored that you guys came out. It's great to have Shane here. He actually participated a lot on the book. He helped me with it a lot. So it's great to be here. This is the final event for the book, and it's so nice to share it with you guys.
And not only have we been friends in Colorado, we also joined up together in San Francisco a few years ago, where much of this book takes place. And when we got to San Francisco, we sort of had a mutual appreciation of the fog and started thinking a little bit about what it's like to live in the fog and what it would be like to do something with the fog. So with that, maybe we could hear something.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I'm going to read a little bit for you just to give you a sense of the fog, which is one of the motifs of the book. I've been thinking about the fog for some time now, how it appears outside my window in the morning while I'm lying in bed, the outside world neither dark nor light, how it moves along the streets like a thousand streams tracing the contours of the city, how it obscures the world, confusing the seen and unseen, and then how it slowly disappears from sight until the world is once again visible. Memory is like the fog. I remember feeling, for the first time, as a teenager, what it was like to forget. How something so concrete could one day disappear. I remarked to a friend that I no longer knew the sound of a voice I once knew so well. The forgetting has stuck with me. And yet, for all the forgetting, much remains. Sorting it out is like walking through the fog in search of some distant part of the city. At times, the past is illuminated, burning, brilliant. Other times, the fog is thick. Often, it is just silently slipping away. Standing, as it were, amid the fog, I sketch the landscape. Sometimes I'm able to see things fairly clearly. Often, much of my view is obscured. At times, I must rely on others when I cannot see past my own feet. Simple sketches are all I can manage. Thoreau and Dillard have their Meteorological Journal of the Mind. I have a fog sketchbook. Memory is real, I've come to think, though it is living. The past mixes with the present, an endless churning. The fog swirls around so that this is visible, and then this is visible, and then this is visible.
So So there's one line in that section where you say, memory is like the fog. That's really interesting for me. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that.
So I think we're all aware of this cliche of a foggy memory. In the art world, now dealing with cliche is somewhat taboo. You're not really supposed to do it. At previous times, when people were in oral traditions, cliches were really important as something that allowed the artwork to really be understood by people. But in literate societies, we don't really do it. So when I was working on this book, I was very aware of this cliche and kind of walking right up to it and hopefully engaging with it a little bit in an interesting way without fully becoming the cliche.
Yeah, and it's actually, so we're going to do this kind of just as a conversation, and it's interesting what you're saying, because we were talking just earlier about the role that cliche plays in all art, in literature in particular, and how once you ride that fine line of cliche, it's almost as if the only stories worth being told are riding that fine line, that have that human and universal component, but that don't ultimately shift into cliche, but that tell you just something to the side of an emotion or feeling that you felt before. It's present here, which is really, really nice to see. I'll move on and say, so one of the other parts that's really interesting, and as I was saying in the very beginning, I've known Kyle for so long, and for some of you that know him as well, he's a relatively private person, and only with very few people, do you sometimes get that opening. But of course, you've chosen to write one of the most intimate books imaginable. I'm curious what that's been like for you.
It's not something I set out to do, for sure. I kind of walked into it by accident. Not that I hadn't written about my brother before. I guess for those of you who may be strangers here, which is probably no one, I think I know all of you probably. But this is being recorded for a podcast, and so for listeners who might not be aware of the book is about San Francisco's fog and my brother's suicide when we were teenagers, which is not something I've stayed away from in life either. As a person or as a writer, in high school, I had written about my brother some, but I never set out to write this book. I think I had written about it, and I was talking to Shane about some writing I had been doing about the fog, and somehow this connection formed, probably because of this this idea of the foggy memory. And here was this book. And I worked on it, and it became a real thing, and then had to make a decision about whether to share it with the world, and was unsure. I remember talking to Shane about this as well. It was a very deep collaboration, you might be gathering. We were in Berkeley, and we had had dinner at an Indian restaurant, and we were talking about, should I try to publish this? It's a total pain to publish a book. There's a lot of anguish involved. Sometimes you're required to speak in front of audiences, which can be anguishing. And Shane and I had this conversation about how important books had been in my life, especially starting in middle school and high school. And that maybe there was some value to this book to others, and I had already done it, and it had some value to me, and I thought, maybe I'll try to publish it and see if others can take something from it.
So yeah, so now that you've sort of outed yourself as a believer, maybe you can be intimate with this group once again, share a little bit more.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
I'm assuming you mean you want me to read.
Yeah.
We're on the same wavelength. So I'm going to read from the first chapter. I do not believe in ghosts. I'm generally skeptical of the immaterial, the spiritual, the otherworldly. And yet, when I'm by myself in the house at night, most any house, if alone, I often look up half expecting my brother Chris to be there. Across the room, hanging, often hanging, though I do not know what that would look like precisely. It is a vague vision, no doubt pulled from movies or photographs, glimpsed and then mostly forgotten. The world outside is dark beyond the window pane. Inside, the lights are on, all of them. I read a book, arranging myself on the couch so that my back is to the wall and I am facing the hallway to the stairs that lead to the basement. I hear the house shift as the temperature drops, a groan from the floorboards, a phantom walking up the stairs. I look up from my book and scan the room. When I get up for a glass of water, I make sure not to walk with my back exposed to. To what? I'm not sure. I reassure myself that Chris would never want to harm me, would never want to scare me, even. Is it Chris, then, who I sense? Why does my mind insist on frightening me with things better left for a 13-year-old child? I am now almost twice as old as Chris ever was. I return to my book. I hold it, physical, real, in my hands. I believe in dirt, skin, tears, rock, blood, sky. I know the cold of water when I step into a mountain stream. When I encounter granite or basalt or sandstone on a hike, I touch it and feel it rough against my skin. I hold the book in my hands and begin to read again. The house continues to groan. The heat kicks on. I look up again. I scan the room. At some point, the night must end and I must put down the book. I brush my teeth in the bathroom, leaving the door open. When I have finished, I walk through the hall, past the stairs, and into the bedroom. I turn on the light by the bed. I then walk back out into the hall, where I glance down the stairs, looking, without looking, before turning off the overhead light and heading back into the illuminated bedroom. I shut the door. When I lived with roommates, the house was rarely empty at night. And now, in the house I share with Julia, I do not think twice about the dark when she is here, with the possible exception of the basement. But when she is gone, at a conference or visiting her parents in D.C., I begin to see the things I know are not there. I lie down, turn off the bedside light, and pull the blanket over my head until morning.
So that's the first chapter. That's the first chapter of the book. But I remember when we were working together, that wasn't the first chapter you sent me. It actually came a lot later. What was the process like in terms of ordering the book and writing?
I mainly just wrote the book as it came to me. Mm-hmm. Once I knew I was working on this project. And I would write a section and then I would send it to Shane here. Sometimes he would reply, sometimes he'd have suggestions, sometimes it was just someone to send something to. And it was nice. I should mention too that my wife looked at everything too, so we have a collaboration too. But yeah, then later on, I worked with Shane and we thought a lot about how to order the book and how to put it together. And that seemed like where I wanted to start the story.
And, you know, a lot of memoirs sort of are looking 10, 20, 30, 40 years back onto a subject, but yours goes back and forth between existing in the time of your memories to some extent and being in the present tense. Was that a conscious choice, or are you looking at what the memoir is doing in general?
Well, it does say memoir on the cover, as everyone can see. My publisher did that. It also says it's a book about forgetting. So the idea that this is a memoir of, you know, a lot of memoirs are these vivid retellings of the past from quite a distance. And I wasn't really trying to do that. I was very interested in memory and this process of forgetting, but I was also very interested in writing about the life I was living at the time and being present and feeling that difference between memory and nostalgia And then also being in the world at this moment.
And did you intentionally go out to get new experiences that you thought would be useful for the book?
Yeah, I did. So I think in terms of process, some writers who are writing this kind of nonfiction book really would tell the story of their childhood, go into great depth about it. But because I was trying to write about the present and trying to engage with this idea of San Francisco in the fog, in the natural world that I was living in, I went out looking for it on these many expeditions to find the fog and to try to put myself in a position to experience the world.
And so, yeah, so we talked about that a lot, just the tension between going out to find inspiration and letting it find you. So when you were going out in search of fog, how do you feel you fared?
Oh, I failed like over and over again. So I had this idea at the beginning that I was going to go put myself in the fog and hang out there. I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but I thought it was going to be great. And I started doing this one spring, and I would go on these walks. And it was always in front of me, and I couldn't find it for a long time. Which, if you live in San Francisco and you're listening to this, you're thinking, this guy is a total idiot. Because if you live in the sunset, you just hang out in the summer, and it will be around you. But I started wanting to do it in the spring, and there wasn't much fog. But it was a happy failure, because this metaphor for the in the story kind of aligned in that I was also at the time going out and trying to capture these memories and also failing at that. So the beginning of the book is the story of me looking for the fog, but also looking for the memories and not being very good at it.
It's hard searching for ephemerality. Maybe we'll do just one last reading.
Sure.
Yeah.
This is going to be chapter 5. I might take a little break in the middle to drink. Here in Colorado, it's very dry. Still, you're fading, falling, drowning out of sight. Photographs collected in boxes and binders. Stories told by mom and dad over lunch. Memories holding on by a sliver. You are in the basement as I am coming home. You are down there now, and I am on the bus. You are there alone, and I am surrounded by school children. It is the last day of classes before winter break. I had a party in homeroom. You had a meeting with mom and the principal. Then you went home. She returned to work. Now you are in the basement. I will be the last to get off the bus. Now it is full of excited children eager to begin their vacation. They get off at each stop, one by one, two by two. They are stepping off the bus. I sit near the back with friends. Felix is driving. You used to sit in the back too. That is where the older kids sat. You and I would move up to the front seat after everyone else had gotten off the bus. We used to listen to Felix tell stories about Puerto Rico. Then you transferred to another school. You did not hear Felix's stories anymore. You were in the basement listening to The Offspring, and I am on the bus. You were moving boxes around the basement. You were measuring distances. I am laughing at a joke on the bus. You are down there, and I am getting closer. I am hungry. I will find a snack when I get home. Maybe a bowl of cereal from the kitchen. Or I will run downstairs and get a pizza from the freezer in the basement. What did you eat when you got home? Are you peeling back the plastic wrap from a frozen burrito? Placing it in the microwave? 325. You think about a girl you used to know. 310. She let you come over to her place. 245. Her room was covered with photos of her friends, cheerleading memorabilia, a mirror in which you saw yourself standing there in front of her. 210. She slowly took off her clothes. 150. She motioned for you to come over to the bed. 120. You hesitated, seeing her like that. 45. You look up at the microwave. 00. You were 16 years old. The bus is empty, and I am sitting in the front with Felix now. A bandage covers the bridge of his nose. He says that before he drove a bus, he spent years working in the sun. Then he tells me a story about the time he ran with a gang called the Latin Kings. He smiles, thinking back on what a reckless teenager he was. His memory appears strong, vivid. He will die years later of cancer. I will hear about it from a friend when I visit Denver in the spring after the ice has melted and everything is green. I open the front door and call out to you. "Hey, Chris," I say, but you do not answer. I go into the family room and turn on the TV. I sit down and watch Saved by the Bell. Then I get up and pour myself a glass of milk in the kitchen. I take a sip and it is cold against my lips. I walk through the house, around the first floor, and then up the stairs. "Where are you?" "Mom is at work and Dad is at work and you are in the basement. I am upstairs walking from room to room wondering where you are. There are wrapped presents in Mom and Dad's room. They are for you and me. Christmas is just a week away." "Where are you?" I am thinking. "You are in the basement, but already you are a memory fading. Photographs and boxes and binders. Stories told over lunch." I sit down in front of the TV, staring, but not really watching, until the phone rings. I get up and walk over to the kitchen. I pick up the receiver and Mom is on the other end and she is talking to me. She asks if you are around and I say I haven't seen you. She is worried. I hear it in her voice. She says there was a meeting at school. I hang up the phone and sit back down. I stare at the TV for another 2 hours. I look over at the clock often. I am 13 and have not yet had a girlfriend or seen a girl without her clothes. The world is out there all around the house and I am in front of the TV. I am here and you are in the basement. I am 13 years old. I do not yet know the limits of memory and so have not looked closely at you. I have not etched your image in my mind. I have not recorded your voice to play back later when I no longer know its sound. I am 13 and I sit in front of the TV with the whole world outside and you are fading. Mom comes home and Dad comes home. They are worried and wonder if you might be at a friend's house. Mom makes calls to parents, but no one knows where you are. We are there in the house with you, but you are not there with us. Mom asks again if I have looked in all the rooms, and I say I have. Then it occurs to me that I have not been downstairs. Dad is opening the door to the basement. He is walking down the wooden steps, one by one. He is bracing himself against the railing as he steps down. I am upstairs with Mom, and you are in the basement. Dad's steps on the stairs are slow and deliberate. He is walking down the stairs. Now he is in the basement. He is screaming now. The world is crumbling in on us. The rafters are being pulled down by your weight. Mom is dialing 911. She is talking to the dispatcher. The dispatcher asks if someone can cut you down. It does not matter, though. You have faded.
You know, it's interesting for me. I've heard it so many times, read it so many times, and I still feel its presence and absence every time. But I wanted to ask you a question about it. That it's always interesting for me how. In the book, when you're writing about events that take place in the past, you write in the past tense, and when you're writing about events that are in the relative present, you write in the present tense. But here, you chose to write about a past event in the present, and I'm curious to know what the relationship is with your thoughts on living in the present, which is so beautifully articulated later in the book.
Someone had asked me a question maybe a week or two ago, and they were saying it's interesting that you know, this forgetting stuff that you're so interested in, it could be seen as a coping mechanism, and a way of dealing with something that's very difficult to deal with. I said, yeah, it would be a good coping mechanism, because I have all these forgotten memories, except for the one thing that I remember most clearly is this piece, and I put it in the present tense, as opposed to the rest of the book. And if it's in the past, it's in the past tense. If it's in the present, it's in the present tense. But this memory, out of all of them, is the one that's alive, so it's in the present tense.
I sincerely have many, many more questions I'd want to just sit up here and talk to you about, but I also am sensitive to the fact that people in the audience probably have even better questions for you. So maybe we can take a few questions from the audience, if anybody has any.
If that's too heavy to ask questions about, we can do our thing some more and you can wait to ask your question. Or you can ask at a later date. But if there are any questions, happy to field any to the best of my ability. Yeah.
Did you write them as two separate stories and then figure out how to intertwine them?
One of the good things about writing a book about forgetting is I feel like I have an out from anything when you ask me. And they're probably, I really should know all of you, and I might not remember all of you. Once again, I will say it's because I have a bad memory. But, so I'm going to ask Shane. Shane will tell you after I answer your question. I think I wrote them concurrently. The piece I just read, I wrote before I was writing the book. I wrote it for the reason, I don't know why people write songs or write anything that they write, but I wrote it because I was writing it. And then a couple of years later, when I was thinking about this project, I thought this would be part of the book. But they did feed on each other. Like I was saying before, I had this project that I was thinking I was going to do with the fog. And I was learning about memory as I was thinking about the fog. And so in that way, I think they really did. There was a dialogue between those two parts of the book.
Completely false. Completely false. No. Actually, it's pretty right on. But one thing I'll add, and Kyle can't say it because he wrote it, but I get to say all the good stuff. Was that we were just talking about books inspiring us when we were younger, but we were really inspired by this book called The Invisible Man and the musicality of it. And when Kyle was talking about how to write this book, it became clear that there were variations on a theme. And as in music, when you have variations on a theme, sometimes you settle into a groove. And so fog chapters just come out and you keep evolving the fog. And so you'll have five or six chapters of fog come out. And then sometimes it'll be more of memories and Chris, and that'll just come together. And then those two, there's a fusion that takes place ultimately, as there is in music where you strike a harmony. And that's something we often talk about in our life, but also in the book too, is just how we can harmonize the all of the elements and understand the tensions and find the melody inside of it.
You can see why I didn't do this by myself. any other questions?
Please.
Yeah.
What's your favorite memory of Chris, and did it make it into the book?
The question is, what's your favorite memory of Chris, and did it make it into the book?
One of the hardest parts of this was, I have several answers for you. I will limit to one. One that you will not be satisfied with.
I'll take more.
There's several parts in the book. So Shane not only is helping me with the book and he is up here, but he's a character in the book. He's someone who I'm interacting with. And over time, in many instances, I'm asking Shane what his memories are, because I don't have them. I specifically remember that Chris was really funny. He was a teenager. He was very young. It was very crude. We probably wouldn't think he's funny if we heard these jokes now. But as a teenager, he was hilarious. And if he was an adult, he would have been hilarious. So we spent a lot of time trying to remember those jokes and really, really wanted to remember those jokes. and could never do it, could never replicate it. Shane came close, but I don't think we ever had it. There's another part of the book where it's basically me explaining home movies, and I have found that many of my memories are actually just my home movies happening in my head. And so I have fond memories of watching home movies. There's one where, who has the hose? Me or him?
Him.
Chris has the hose and he's chasing me around the front yard with it. And then I steal it from him, I think. Okay. And then I bop him on the head.
Yeah.
And he starts crying, and it's hilarious. but then the hose also the length of the hose is it's pretty short, and it runs out, and that section ends with that, and that was also reminded us that all these memories were running out.
Yeah, I'll just add on. Please. Yeah, That joke section was really hard, actually, finding jokes for Chris. And I think one of the reasons was we were 13, Chris was 16, and he was larger than life. And he was also sort of an impressions person. And I think the fondest memories I have of Chris are just coming in on Monday morning and doing the Saturday Night Live routine, just sort of even better than it was on TV. And hard to put that into a book, but one of the other interesting things about trying to find these memories and trying to listening to Kyle as he's going out to search for the memories is this process that happens in art quite often, where you're trying to you take your camera out and you try and look at how can you possibly still a moment to its essence. And the camera, in a way, is a vehicle through which you can do it. You know, having the camera lets you see the world in this photographic lens where an essential moment is possible. And there's a tension in that, going to search for something that by its very nature will move further and further away from you via the act of searching. And so we were conscious of that in the process, Kyle in particular, just really tuning into what can and cannot be accomplished by effort and by effortfully trying to remember something.
Pops.
Pops. As is Pops.
For those of you who haven't, could you explain the thinking behind chapter 43?
The question is, can you explain the thinking behind chapter 43?
This one. Do you
want
to ask the question?
Yeah.
So the question is about chapter 42 of the book, which is blank. A couple of weeks ago, I got a text from my mom, and she said, "Is chapter 42 supposed to be two or three blank pages?" And I wrote her back and I said, "No, it's supposed to be five blank pages." And then she texted me again and she said, "Wow, at some point I'd like to see those pages, what they're supposed to say." I had to text her back and say, "They're not redacted." These are the unknown things. And that's really, it's really the book. And my mom has read it a couple times and she gets the book. And I think it is really a sign of how difficult that idea is to let go of, that there might be more answers. There might be more to find out. But yeah, that's the blank pages.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, we can, of course, there's we can think about it and talk about what that means too, but of course, blank is something as well in its own way. Kyle's not allowed to say that.
If I were a really brave performer, which I am not, I'm chicken, I would perform chapter 42 for you. I've been thinking about it. I've been preparing myself. John Cage did something like this. It's been done before, but but I can't do it. Maybe in a couple of years I'll have some practice and I'll do chapter 42 for you.
All right, you heard it here. I think we had a question over there. Yeah. Wonderfully written. But,
so you have exposed yourself, essentially, in your experiences, and I wonder if you ever think about how the exposure of yourself has landed with other people, the readers of your books, and how they've internalized your experience, and if you have any thoughts on what you wonder about.
Do you wonder about how exposing yourself has landed on your readers, and if you could offer any thoughts on that?
This is, you can cross-reference the anguish part mentioned earlier. I tried to avoid thinking about it too much because I can't control it now. It's out in the world. So I'm conscious of the reader, especially when I was working on it. And I'm grateful for readers. But I can't really control that process at this point, so I can't get too hung up on it. But when people talk to me about it or tell me they liked it or were moved by it, that means a lot to me. I won't say more because then I'll probably cry, and that's not good for the podcast.
Anyone else? Yeah, please.
You don't get to answer this one, Shane. This is Kyle's. Okay. Since you've gone to the trouble to put yourself out there so much, I'll ask you just your personal feelings on Chris's life and death, and how they changed before writing the book and after you, which you took a lot to yourself and inside yourself, and your feelings on his life and death. After writing the book, and really, you gave it a lot of thought since the day he died, I know. But actually putting it into more of a tangible outside of just your own writings, but published work and research, just how your own internal feelings have changed on before and after writing.
So if you could talk a little bit about your personal feelings of Chris's life and death and how they've changed from before you wrote the book to after you wrote the book.
Some interviewer asked me about my growth through the book, and I denied that it happened. I was like, no, these things happened, and I wrote it down, and then she cited something. And then I was like, oh, sorry, I just lied to you. Of course, I grew through. I had some growth. The interesting thing for me is it was 20 years ago. I had thought about it a lot and thought, I have come to terms with this. I'm ready to write about it, but I didn't necessarily think that I was going to learn about my thoughts and my feelings in the way that I did. In a practical sense, I encountered this narrative about his death, that I had heard when I was young and internalized, which was, he got in trouble for dealing drugs. He had used drugs. The eulogy that's included in the book, says that drugs destroyed his mind and he went crazy, and so that's one thing that I really wanted to address in the book, this idea that you can have a simple narrative that explains someone's death, especially by suicide. I've tried to learn about that. In theory, I told my wife that this year, I'm 33, I was going to do drugs because I haven't really done them in my life. I haven't done a very good job of it, But in theory, if anyone has any, maybe we can talk about it. But that was just one, like one of many things that there's also this AP article in the book. I came across this, and it was about drugs at Highlands Ranch High School, and it mentioned my brother's death, and there was an explanation. And I looked at that and thought, all these people in Denver, or it was on the AP, so it might have been, I know it was national news. This was a life, and it was distilled into this one moment with this one cause. And no life is that simple. And so this book goes into detail about Chris's life to some extent, but I think it goes for any life when you're reading the news and have some explanation, or you're at your work and there's someone who is something's happened with them or whatever, taking a little bit of time to think about all the factors in their lives and all these lives seems important.
I'll just add one quick thing, and then maybe we have time for one or two more questions, but it's just a practice that I think writing the book helped instill in both Kyle and myself, which is, you know, looking at the cause behind the cause behind the cause behind the cause of everything and of every encounter we come to when we're engaging with a person, and to look clearly and understand as much as we possibly can, knowing that we'll never understand everything, but that it's more than what you see on the surface. And this doesn't necessarily mean digging deep and trying to unravel everything, but it does mean looking layers beyond, and not settling really any time, and certainly not settling for just what's on the face. A couple more questions would be great. We'll do one here and then last one for the wife, as she was referred to earlier.
You want to repeat the question?
Sure. Just are you mad at Chris?
No.
And how that's progressed for you?
Yeah, I can't say that I'm angry. I think I was probably, obviously I was upset. I think I was probably angry. Was I angry?
Yeah.
One of my teachers says that I was angry in addition. There's some, yeah. I was probably angry. I don't feel that way. Maybe the book helped with that. 20 years helps, I think. One of the sub-themes of the book is this idea of wilderness. The book is something of a nature book. And our sense of control. And I think suicide really is hard for us to deal with because it really threatens our sense of control, because we feel like if this is happening around us, we are not in control of the world, and we are constantly searching for control, at least in our society. We're trying to control nature, control our lives, control everything around us. And one of the things that is somewhat liberating for me about being in the non-human world is giving up that sense of control, being in the world, feeling its reverberations around me, and being somewhat accepting of that.
So we'll take one last question.
Of your tour, and I'm curious for you what it was like to put people you know present day in the book, both in the past and in the present, and what it was like for you, Shane, to be working on that. Like, was there, were you having to fight instincts of like, that's not what I would have said, or edit anything about yourself or other people as they showed up? I know, you know, I had experiences of being in the book and being like, I don't know if that's how, okay, it's your book, you can write. And I will also say, just for the benefit of those of you here, that I come off very good in this book, and I'm not a perfect person, so just be aware that there's editing of me. Probably not of anyone else who comes off really good, though.
This question comes from my wife, who wants to know something about the people who are in the book. My wife is in the book. It's somewhat awkward. We are going to have many years together. She probably could have asked this at some other time. She really thinks that in front of all of you, everyone listening to the podcast, I should address her question. It's probably as awkward writing about other people I know as it is writing about myself. And to try to be honest and to capture something of who they are. And I did my best. And luckily, my wife is much smarter than I am. So it's easy to write well of her. And she's a very nice person. She's lovely. I feel like I should have brought my vowels here today. What should I say?
I'm curious more about, you've included Shane, you've included other people who may or may not be in this room, but who know you guys, and what that process was like. I'm more curious about Shane, because I know you well, but Shane, as you were reading your friends, and you were reading yourself, and you were reading Kyle in the book, these weren't characters who were being fictionalized. So there's some delicacy to it, and there's also some honesty, and this book is clearly quite honest. So what was that like for you to be editing a book that you were also in and about people you know?
Kyle, do you want to take this one?
Shane might be more of a private person than I am, actually. Go for it.
No, for me, despite the fact that I should be bigger, faster, stronger in the book, I think I just trust Kyle, and trust that he'll be sensitive with the real lives involved, and because everyone in it is a real person that really loves him and has spent so much time with him, and also that the relationships extend beyond the book. That how a person is depicted in the book, they're depicted in that way honestly, but they're also depicted in that way in service of the book, and in service of what I think Kyle might hope the book can do. And so it's a great exercise, actually, in seeing yourself or seeing a version of yourself and sublimating whatever egoistic tendencies you might have in service of something that you believe in. And so, I mean, for that, I think I'm grateful. And I think even people whose presence meant so much to Kyle, even their absence is not a statement, is not reflective of their importance, or shouldn't be attached to, may not need to be attached to a sense of ego, but having a deep knowledge that everything that Kyle has ever thought, said, or felt is a reflection of everyone who's ever interacted with him, and that comes out in service of his art. And I think that's ultimately what I think the highest hope we could hope for. Kyle should really have the last word, though. So let's maybe say something else, or someone just give him a volley, please. Yeah, please.
I guess I wondered if you felt closer to your brother after writing this, if the process of thinking through the memories actually made the memories more real,
realized those were memories, and then, you know, what your relationship is with him now.
There's this part in the book where I'm hanging out with Shane on top of some hill somewhere in San Francisco. We're talking about, it's the part where we're trying to think of a joke, I think. We get to the end of this conversation, the end of the chapter. And I asked Shane, we're good friends, right? Chris and me. And it's such a ridiculous line that if it were a novel, it could never be included in the book. It's so preposterous. And Shane says, yeah, you were really good friends. So that relationship existed. It doesn't exist anymore. There's a new one, that we have. And there's something that, a relationship with my parents that has been strengthened because of writing the book. And they have got a lot out of it, I think. Except for the blank chapter. And yeah, that's been really good for us.
Okay. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for reading the book, for being a part of this. I feel opened in a really, really beautiful way.
Thank you all. It's a pleasure.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.